On the 200th birthday of the First Amendment, a survey was done for the American Society of Newspaper Editors. That survey found that the First Amendment would not be ratified by Americans if it were put before them today. We Americans have come to think of our First Amendment to our Constitution as a shield for pornographers and bigots, religious charlatans, flag burners, fanatics, and journalists. On this edition of Conversations, a lifelong journalist looks at the First Amendment and the press. I'm Susan McInnes for KUAC-FM. Welcome, please, Paul McMasters. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I paraphrased, almost stole from your own speech. Tell me more about that survey. What did it ask that it found that the First Amendment would not be accepted?
It asked a whole range of questions that got down, I guess, to the fine print that follows the 45 words of the First Amendment and really delved into how Americans really think about free speech and free expression rights. And I guess the best way to sum up the findings were that the American people believe that they believe in free speech, but what they really believe in is just free speech for themselves, not the other guy.
Is this an instance of theory being easier to take than practice?
Yes, and then you pointed out in your introduction that most people have grown so accustomed to the way the First Amendment works in their daily lives that it's sort of a part of the wallpaper now, and they don't see how necessary it is to daily living in a democracy. So when they are confronted with these radical exercises of the First Amendment, they say, do we really need this? I feel that we do need it. If we come to a place in our society where one group has authority over other groups or other individuals as to what they can say or think, then democracy as we know it is no longer a part of what we're doing in the United States.
Why would a weakened First Amendment mean that one group would come to dominate? What leads from one thing to the other in your mind?
Always in a situation where a minority or a majority of citizens cannot or do not make their views known and participate in government, then the demagogues take over. And demagoguery is anathema to democracy. I feel that we could find any number of good reasons to shut people up or shut people out. In fact, censorship invariably is done for the best of intentions, but those best of intentions often, almost always, result or have the worst of results. And that's why I try to spend as much of my time as I can talking about the importance in our lives of First Amendment rights and values and responsibilities.
This is Paul McMasters. As we are speaking together, as we're recording this interview, he's just completing his year-long tenure as the president of the Society for Professional Journalists. That's an organization founded in 1909, the nation's oldest and largest journalism organization. As part of his work as president of SPJ, Paul McMasters has visited each of the 50 states talking about a free press and the importance of the First Amendment in American life. You're listening to Conversations. Bring this to an issue level. What do you think? Find an issue we're dealing with in the United States today, in the democracy today, where the inclination is to restrict freedom of speech or religion or right to assembly or any of the things guaranteed in the First Amendment, and then critique that for me. What's wrong with what's wrong with the best intentions?
I think the issue of violence on television probably is of concern to more Americans today than just about any other issue, because most Americans feel that we are awash in crime and violence, and we feel that we don't have any real tools to solve this problem with. So along come those who would give us the quick fix, those who would say that it's violence on television that's causing the violence on the street. If we just eliminate violence on television, then we will have curbed violence on the street. Nothing could be further from the truth, in my opinion. But this whole thing illustrates the way the First Amendment gets lost in the public dialogue over a pressing public issue. In this instance, we are proposing to give up very vital First Amendment rights of broadcasters to put on what they think is best for their audiences, both in entertainment, education, news, and information. What they are willing to do is turn over a giant remote control to unelected bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. to determine what we can or cannot see on television. Now, that might not seem like such a big deal, and I guess I could even go along with it, if I thought for a second that it would have any effect at all on violence on the street. But I know it won't, and even those who have conducted the studies will not say that will have any impact. You cannot arrest violence on the street by slapping handcuffs on the First Amendment, and that's what's being proposed.
Let's deal with that question first. You think then that violence on the street comes from some other source other than what we might be conditioned to do by a broadcast?
I don't guess it's important what I think as much as it is what people smarter than I am think. And I think even the most radical of demagogues on this issue of violence on television will concede that probably the core causes of violence in our society today have to do with poverty, have to do with the availability of guns, have to do with the availability of drugs, and have to do with the breakdown in the family and the sense of community. Those are things you can't address with a quick fix. Those things have evolved over decades and will more than likely take decades to fix. A politician in Washington doesn't have decades to address it. A man or woman on the street facing crime on a daily basis doesn't have decades to fix it. They want the streets to be safe for their children today. So we look for somebody to blame, something to blame, something that will give us a quick fix. And there's television, something that we always look to for salvation or blame, no matter what the issue is.
Well, now, what about looking at the question in this way? There are people who say that producers, directors, the people who create television for us don't have our best interests at heart, don't have the higher values of a democracy at heart. They've got the bottom line. They've got the money that's going to come to them for creating a popular low-level program. And that if that program doesn't, or that kind of programming doesn't lead to violence in the street, then it numbs us and it makes us think that there's more violence than there really is. So it perpetuates this notion of a violent society by perpetuating it in our minds, if not with our bludgeons. And so why not use an outside source to spur producers to create better programming?
Well, you raised two good issues there that I think that we haven't spent a lot of time thinking about. One is the cry is made that if nothing else, so much violence on television desensitizes us to violence and crime, and therefore we're more prone to fall into it. I submit to you that I don't think that this society has ever been more sensitive to violence. How else do you explain this enormous, pervasive public dialogue about violence? And why else would political figures in Washington decide this was a great issue to seize on? Because people are talking about it. That relates to the second issue. Why are people talking about it? Why do they have this sense of doom about crime and violence? In the last year alone, networks have doubled their coverage of crime and violence on the network news. That comes at a time when, since 1979, crime has steadily decreased in the society. all kinds of crime, including violent crime. But because the media, my colleagues in the media, have not given context to their coverage of crime, the average citizen feels that it is everywhere, it's pervasive, and it's going to get them next. Now, that's not all bad, because there are some areas to be very, very concerned about as far as crime is concerned. One, crime is more random now than it's ever been, and two, crime is being committed by ever younger people today than it ever was. So those two things are on the increase and are a valid concern. But I don't think my colleagues in the media have done a very good job of putting in that in context. And as a consequence, I think that people fear crime more than the statistics warrant.
A quick question and then a longer one. Who are you quoting when you say since 1979 crime has steadily decreased? Who's holding
the Justice Department and FBI statistics.
Okay. And now what about putting crime in context? What is the press not doing to fully show what's happening on the streets?
Well, you have a lot of local television stations who have adopted the philosophy used in the trade that if it bleeds, it leads, meaning that that the ratings go up if you show crime on your local news shows. The networks have picked up on that also. And as a consequence, you find that you not only have the news shows looking a lot at crime and violence, you have your so-called tabloid television, your reality-based television, and your news magazines, all of them focusing on it, and the printed press follows along mindlessly without anybody ever pointing out this decrease in crime and the fact that things are getting better in across the board. That's where your question comes from. Where do I get this information? Nobody has bothered to go and report that on a regular basis. As a matter of fact, USA Today and other major newspapers last month reported that, but it was not a screaming headline, or it didn't lead off a television newscast. So the average American just doesn't get that sense of context.
You know, I want to go forward with this question, but I want to go back to something that I noted in a column of yours, and I think is an important way to at least put a wrap on our first discussion of First Amendment and why it might be fragile. You wrote a column for Quill magazine, which is the magazine of the Society for Professional Journalists, on the fragility of a free press. In there, you cited Russian President Boris Yeltsin as banning and censoring communist newspapers and television programs after the attempted coup in his country, and then held that almost in the same hand with American Attorney General Janet Reno's interest in restricting television programming. Why are those two on the same plate? How can we hold those two?
Because the natural, I guess, human impulse of people in power is to control everything, including news, including those who report on their activities. And if we give over power to those individuals, then we give up any right at all to question those individuals or even to monitor their activities, because we are relying on their version of what happened to make our own judgments. That is not something that people with a democratic tradition can abide or should abide. Our elected officials serve at the will of the people. The will of the people is thwarted if they cannot have a constant, credible flow of information from a free and unfettered press.
Is in some ways this battle that you wage similar to the battle that Second Amendment defenders are now waging, where someone else, a government or a collection of individuals, are trying to put a restriction on that amendment, and because they're saying things are going too far, assault weapons or violence on television or an irresponsible press, and so therefore someone more responsible than the individual, the government, must put controls on?
I think there are parallels, Susan, but what I should point out is that even a First Amendment absolutist like myself recognizes and acknowledges certain responsible restrictions on expression. I don't, for instance, say that we should have totally free ability to put obscenity on the air or to publish child pornography or to do things of that nature or to have unrestricted access to national security secrets, that sort of thing. So indeed there are restrictions on the First Amendment. And I think reasonable things can be expected of the Second Amendment rights to bear arms. I, for instance, don't see any constitutional threat in asking for waiting periods or requiring certain other kinds of responsible actions that will cut down on the carnage out there without infringing upon the rights of sportsmen, hunters, gun collectors, and others who can and do use guns responsibly.
In both cases, the debate is the important issue. I'm asking if this is so for you, that when people talk about their right to hold assault weapons and when people talk about their right to publish pornography, what happens in the hammock between is the debate, and that's what's the most important thing.
That is very important, and I have to tell you that if I were the one making the rules, I would see no threat to this country from allowing pornography to be published or obscenity to be published, and I would see no threat to this country from allowing assault weapons to be sold. I see a greater threat to this country from rescinding the Second Amendment or rescinding the First Amendment or otherwise damaging it by law.
This is Conversations. We're talking today with Paul McMasters, 31 years, a working journalist. He spent the last period of his time before he came to his current positions with USA Today. He was an associate editor for USA Today, responsible for the day-to-day operations for the National Daily's editorial pages. He began his journalism career writing obituaries for the Springfield, Missouri Daily News in 1960 while he was a freshman at Southwest Missouri State University. During 21 years with the Springfield newspapers, he worked as a general assignment reporter, copy editor, city editor, and assistant managing editor of the Daily News. As I say, he last worked for working newspapers at USA Today. Paul McMasters is now a vice president with the Freedom Forum, headquartered in Arlington, Virginia, and executive director of the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University, Nashville, Tennessee. The Freedom Forum is dedicated to free speech, free press, and free spirit around the world. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. Let's get back to the working press. Why is it in so much disarray in the American consciousness? I was thinking before we sat down to talk that politicians, lawyers, and journalists have to have the worst rep in the country. These are, in some ways, our representatives to the democracy.
Yeah, even car salesmen, used car salesmen, don't want to be categorized with the press and politicians and lawyers today. And I like the word that you just used, disarray, because I think that best characterizes the situation. And what we have to decide as journalists today is whether this period of disarray puts us on the brink of disaster or the cusp of change. And I hope we tip to the latter. But I think it's going to require a lot of work on the part of journalists. Journalists have never been under more intense or frequent attack than they are today. And that's ironic, because journalists have never been more educated, more sophisticated, and never have they spent more time agonizing over what they cover and what they report. What the public doesn't realize is how much winds up on the cutting room floor or in the wastebasket in the newsroom. Journalists probably keep out as much as they ever publish or broadcast simply because they can't nail it down, or they think it's not ethical, or for some other reason do not believe that they have got a good story that's a fair and balanced story. But the public never sees that. So what the public does see, it makes its judgments on. And the irony comes in here is that while we have really arguably the best press corps we've ever had, we also have a public today that is more sophisticated, more demanding, and has never been more willing to challenge and question any and all of the institutions in our society, including the press. So that's why we have a lot of questions and a lot of attacks. Then there are other things. That's a change in society. We also have a change in the economy that affects the press, and a big change in technology. So a lot of previously unmentionables as far as the press was concerned and competition was concerned have now come into their own. Cable, mm-hmm. electronic, fiber optic, the bulletin boards on the information highway, and as a whole array of new media out there that threaten to be competition with the press. So the press is trying to redefine itself and to meet that competition head on, and it does cause disarray.
Mm-hmm. There's another aspect that I think people would think of first, though, prior to some of the things you've said, and that's that what has the brightest neon light in the press is what we think of as sleaze journalism, tabloid journalism, checkbook journalism. These are awful things to be known by, and yet I think the press is first known by these qualities, not the Pulitzers and not the efforts to be ethical in a time of great change.
There is another irony, obviously, at work here, and that is that the public, according to a survey taken not long ago by the Times Mirror Corporation, does not make any distinction between the so-called legitimate press and hard copy or tabloid TV or checkbook journalism. And in their minds, that is all one thing. So that hurts the credibility that the press has, and the press cannot operate without credibility.
Why is that so?
There's two reasons for it. One is the press's fault. It has not done a good job of defining itself and distances itself from this kind of operations, which really are quite questionable from an ethical viewpoint and from an information viewpoint. The other part of the blame goes with the public, who is insisting more and more these days that any information they receive is not valuable in itself. It's got to be sugar-coated and wrapped in entertainment. It's got to be exciting and dramatic and surprising and lurid before we'll even tune in. We talked a little bit about this particular thing earlier in our conversation, and I have to say that people who put things on television do so looking at the bottom line. It is a business to them. They're not charitable institutions. They are not out there just to be nice. And just to provide information or what have you to the American public. They're there to make money and to stay in business. And they have found that whether it's violence on television or sugarcoating the news or blurring the distinction between the legitimate news and the tabloid television gets the ratings. So who do you blame there?
Mm-hmm.
The television producers and the news media for giving the public what it wants, or the public for wanting that sort of stuff?
How about you? Who do you blame?
I find, as I say, that there's enough blame to put in both on both front porches. I really think, as a society, we've got to be a little more serious about the information that comes to us that we need to judge how our government is performing and how our society is progressing. And we are too busy today with leisure activities and too wanting to be entertained to sit down and do the serious business of being a good citizen.
We're going to talk more about this, but are you optimistic about our ability to grab back this responsibility of the democracy?
Oh, yes. In my travels around the country, I started out a lot more pessimistic than optimistic, but the people that I've met who share these concerns and in many instances have much more creative and better solutions in mind than even I do, really give me hope. I take heart because we sell the American people short too often. They're a lot smarter than the politicians or the pundits give them credit for. And that's what we've got to return to in the press. Having faith in the people, having faith in the facts. If we just give the people the facts, they will do the right thing. You've seen and read and seen television shows and movies about the hard-boiled, crusty, cynical journalist. The true journalist has never been cynical. In fact, the true journalist is a real romantic because she or he truly believes that if they just give the American people the facts, the American people will take those and do the right thing. And there is a great group of good journalists out there who really believe that. I was talking to a journalist the other day who really summed it up for me. She said, we were talking about all these issues and problems and this disarray in the media today. And she ended the conversation by saying, well, despite all of that, on my worst days in the newsroom, I really feel like I'm doing something honest.
Nice. This is Paul McMasters with us on Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. I mentioned the Freedom Forum and the First Amendment Center. Just let me tell you a little bit more about that. The Freedom Forum is a nonpartisan, financially independent foundation, as I said, dedicated to free speech, free press, and free spirit around the world. The First Amendment Center, which was established in 1991, the 200th anniversary of the Bill of Rights, has as its mission the fostering of public appreciation and understanding of First Amendment rights and values. Paul McMasters is a vice president of the Freedom Forum and the executive director of the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University. As you are listening to this, he will have completed his one-year term as the president for the Society for Professional Journalists. He spent a good deal of that time traveling the United States, talking to the public and to other journalists about the profession and the First Amendment. I'm curious, has the First Amendment Center ever been accused of having an agenda, of being non-objective, of being a special interest?
That's a tough one. We've never been accused of that, but I think that that has been implicit in some of the questions asked of me or the chairman, John Siegenthaler, on occasion. And certainly, being an advocate for the First Amendment puts you in the category, in some people's minds, of a special interest. But of all the things that we have in our traditions and in our Constitution, this first liberty is probably the most remarkable compact between a government and its people, known in all of history, known in all of the world. It, in 45 words, lays out five fundamental freedoms without which the human being can never reach its full potential, and without which the society cannot reach its full potential. So when somebody wants to define that as a special interest, I guess I have to say I can't think of a special interest that goes more to the heart of working for all of the people all of the time than the five basic freedoms that makes a person a full person.
Do you think the founding fathers sensed that this would be perceived as a disruptive and a potentially dangerous collection of words?
It certainly was a radical one. It has its roots in the Greek and Roman democracies. It has its foreshadowing in things like the Magna Carta. And it finally had its first real iteration in the Bill of Rights of the Commonwealth of Virginia. But it bloomed full-fledged as the 45 words in the First Amendment when the ratification of the Constitution came along. And the father of those 45 words was James Madison, being coached by Thomas Jefferson. And both had every reason in the world to hate the press, and indeed did. But both also recognized that the press was part of freedom of expression, and that freedom of expression was the main criterion for freedom of thought. And if you could not have freedom of thought, then you did not truly have a democracy. So asking for that guarantee was a real gesture on the part of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison toward the idea that any government has no real claim to legitimacy unless it gives those five freedoms: the freedom to think and believe or not believe as one wishes, the freedom to talk or not speak as one wishes, the freedom to publish or write or express oneself as one wishes, the freedom to gather peacefully to talk about these ideas that they're thinking, and the freedom to petition the government for redress of grievances based on those things, are all of one piece. They are the five fingers of one hand. You cannot have one without having the others, and any threat to any one of them is a threat to all of them.
If it's a little disconcerting, is it also appropriate in your mind that in this age of identity politics and diversification of what we think of as the American, or yes, I can say it in that way, that we are battling over these very issues, that the debate is being held anew?
The irony always is, too, that the one thing that the First Amendment guarantees is the ability of people to challenge the validity of the First Amendment. No other system has that particular ability, and that is the particular strength and at once the particular fragility of this first liberty. And it's something that we have to worry a lot about, because you cannot any longer, at least, wade into a debate or a dialogue, wave the First Amendment flag, declare victory, and walk away. You have to be able to contend with the very strong emotional arguments that are being put forward, especially in the diversity field. But I think that's our salvation there, not a problem, but a part of the solution. The First Amendment, if it stands for anything, stands for search for common ground. It is not something that espouses people lining up on either side of a line and hurling epithets at one another, shaking their fist at one another, and adopting a hard line that does not recognize any validity in what's being said on the other side. That is why, to a certain extent today, because we've lost sight of that search for common ground that the First Amendment calls for, that we have come very close to political, social, and intellectual gridlock in our society. People shaking their fist at one another instead of talking with one another. So if the First Amendment does anything, as our nation, for good or ill, and I think probably for good, divides itself into ever smaller units and smaller communities, that we have the First Amendment grow stronger and stronger, because it is the one thing, especially through the press, that guarantees a sense of the larger community. And that's what we really have to protect the First Amendment for.
In that context, give me some quick reactions to a couple of fiery phrases. Speech codes is one. What should we do with those things? Are they good, bad, evil?
Junk them. There is nothing that I can think of more dangerous to a democracy and more inimical to the idea of an institution of higher learning than a codification, a law that criminalizes words, ideas, and images. There's a better way to address bad things on campus than criminalizing thought. And if that is not persuasive, then just let me tell you that speech codes, for all the years they have been around, have not done anything to staunch the amount of hate crime and hate speech that's going on our college campuses today. They simply have not worked.
Nat Hentoff says two things. He says, if I call you a water buffalo, you shouldn't charge me with something. You ought to come and talk to me about it, that we need to have that face-to-face. The other thing he says, if I am forced to shut my mouth when I want to call you a water buffalo, then my hatred will be driven underground and I will become more dangerous.
It makes cannot sense? Be addressed. That's a very good point. Another good point that I think that most people are not apprised of is that speech codes have wound up punishing women and minorities more often than white males, who essentially were the original targets of speech codes. And a lot of people don't understand that or recognize that. So that is an inevitable result of entrusting to a law or regulation supposedly protecting minorities and women and other groups on campus, entrusting enforcement of that to the very individuals and institutions that are accused of the bias and bigotry in the first place.
How about political correctness and self-censorship? I can't talk to you about this because it's not politically correct.
It has dumbed down and dampened all sorts of dialogues across the board in all of our communities, nowhere more dangerously than on the college campus. And what it means is that whole courses are being eliminated from the catalogs. It means that professors are being told they can or cannot say certain things in their classes. It tells many students to keep their mouths shut during class discussions. And students will tell you they do, because the conversation clincher or stopper is for someone to rise up, point their finger at somebody and say, "You're a racist, you're a sexist, you are a gay basher." No one wants to be labeled that way, even if they have a legitimate comment that doesn't follow the PC way of thinking. So people just clam up, and that's dangerous to a democracy.
What's your advice if somebody stands up and says to you, "Paul McMasters, you're a racist"? What would you say in response?
It's a tough one, Susan, because I got to tell you, that's intimidating. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be called a racist or a sexist or a homophobe. No way do I want to be labeled that. And it does make me couch things a lot more carefully sometimes. Now, to the extent that that's sensitive and inclusive, that's good. To the extent that it keeps me from putting forward an idea that should be considered, that's very bad. So my advice is to people, dare to do it. I dare to do it. And I especially advocate that for members of college faculties who have tenure, who have the freedom to do so without endangering their jobs and their reputations. Nowhere else in our society do you have that sort of protection, yet you have brave, courageous people doing that all over society. In fact, I have to say that I see less courage there on the part of college faculty members than I would like to see. They've got to lead the way out of this morass.
And then stay in the ring. I mean, you can't
just go
in and take a quick slap and run out again, right?
Exactly right.
Yeah. Paul McMasters is with us on Conversations, our topics today, the First Amendment and its implications and the threats against it from his perspective, and also the working press. We'll return to the working press in about 30 seconds. In 1994, the Paul McMasters First Amendment Award was established at Tennessee State University. It will be given to a student journalist each year for work furthering First Amendment rights and values. Paul McMasters has been given a number of awards himself. In this last year, a Journalism Leadership Award by the Society of Professional Journalists Student Chapter at Tennessee State University, also by the SPJ Student Chapter at Washington and Lee University, both for furthering the interests and issues of the First Amendment. A First Amendment Award also came from the Vermont Press Association and the SPJ Project Sunshine for Freedom of Information work in 1993. Paul McMasters, our guest today on Conversations. I want to ask you to talk about what we think of as manipulations of the press and why the press is vulnerable to manipulation. Here are a couple of comments. One is Amy Fisher's lawyer. Again, you wrote this, and I'm quoting from you. Amy Fisher's lawyer says, "If I give you deliberate misinformation on behalf of my client and you print it, that's your problem. I could take nothing, put it in a fancy wrapper, and get it on television. It's as simple as that." Another fellow, Charles Wolforth, a former reporter at the time of your writing, a member of the Anchorage Municipal Assembly, said that reporters are not skeptical enough of politicians' motivations. Public policy considerations rarely enter into the decision of most politicians. The truth is told only when it's convenient. Both these fellows have reporters on the end of strings. Why? How did reporters get there?
part of the problem is that journalists, many journalists today, have become closer to their the people they cover than the people they cover them for. And that means that they have to protect their sources and that they rely on their sources as the sole fountain of information or the primary fountain of information. So they're at their mercy as far as what information they get to provide to the public. The other thing is that with downsizing and the economy being the way it is, the average reporter today is given much more work than she or he has time to do. So they therefore wind up having to give a particular story often just a lick and a promise and not really getting into it deeply, either because of time constraints, competitive constraints, or they just don't have the resources to do the job they're supposed to do. But above and beyond all of that, we have grown up there a whole career group of people who have learned to handle and manipulate the media and do so for people who need that done for a price. Now, I want to be very careful to say that there are public affairs and public relations people out there that are even more ethical than most journalists are. And they're very good at the jobs, and they do just try to get the particular set of facts out, and they don't try to manipulate the media. But you have lawyers in major cases, and you have handlers for politicians, and you have people who don't have the best of motives for what they're trying to promote, who are very good at getting the media to do what they want it to do, simply because, not because the media wants to be complicit in this arrangement, but because many of the individual reporters and editors working on individual stories don't have time to do the best possible job on it. Now, I do have to say that the truth eventually comes out, but a lot of damage sometimes is done in the interim.
And some of that damage is certainly to the credibility of journalists. So
absolutely.
So people who read the newspaper, who watch the news, read it with a cynicism. So it's, again, it perpetuates itself. So given the situation as you've described it, how does the working press get out of it and begin to... How does the working press get out of it?
Well, as I said a while ago, one of the things it has to do is distance itself from bad practices of tabloid TV and tabloid journalism, distinguish itself from that kind of activity. A second thing it has to do, and is a relatively easy thing to do but has been traditionally resisted by the mainstream press, is to cover the press better. We in the press so often call this inside baseball, and so we almost shut down news reporting on arguably the most important institution outside of government in our society, and that is the media. We need to explain ourselves better. We need to defend ourselves better. We need to advocate for the First Amendment better. I have never seen an instance of where a member of the public, even of an avid critic, a harsh critic of the press, has been invited in to sit down at a news meeting with editors and reporters and watch them and listen to them as they hash out the day's news and how they're going about playing it in the paper today. I have never known of an instance when that harsh critic of the press didn't walk out of that newsroom much more enlightened and much more positive about the press. And we just need to do a better job of that, of explaining ourselves to the public. The public's not dumb. They're smart. But viscerally right now, they know that they're being shut out. And they also see the press doing a lot of molding, mangling, and manipulating the news each day into a, quote, product. And the reader says, or the listener says, or the viewer says, wait a minute. If the news is so malleable, then maybe it isn't that valuable. We have got to restore the confidence of our audiences in objective facts and neutral reporting as much as possible. And we've got to do a better job of covering stories, because you will find that anybody who is an expert in a situation sees a story on that particular area that she or he is an expert in, finds that there is just, it's just riddled with mistakes. That doesn't go to building confidence. That doesn't go to building credibility.
So should that writer then write a column, write an article, do something?
That is another way of restoring credibility, and we are really pretty good in the press about that today, mm-hmm. and that is giving the readers and the audiences much more participation in responding, giving them larger areas to respond in letters to the editor, more ways of responding in letters to the editor. We're doing more focus groups. We're doing more surveys. So the public is getting to participate in the process a lot more than it ever did before, and I think that's good.
I have a fairly touchy question for you. Maybe it's not. I don't know. USA came under quite a bit of criticism, still comes under quite a bit of criticism for not giving full stories, for short articles and punchy headlines and vibrant pictures, but not a lot of depth. Isn't depth something that's important?
Well, I think I can defend USA Today pretty well on that, not being there any longer. I feel like that I've got some legitimate criticisms of what USA Today does in specific areas. But what you just bring up is, ironically, a superficial criticism that one hears from people who really have not looked at USA Today or read it on a regular basis. USA Today does have short stories in many cases and only has one jump a day from the main fronts, but that does not mean it lacks depth. In fact, USA Today was the first newspaper ever to devote a whole editorial page to one topic each day and gave over space each day, and still does, to an opposing view to the main editorial. There's plenty of depth there. The whole op-ed page piece was usually only one or two subjects and given in depth. But let's go to the news itself. The pieces of a story are merely broken up into pieces. If you look at a major story in USA Today, you'll find that it consists of several elements. The main story with references to other stories elsewhere in the paper, and there will usually, to a major story, be a information graphic that conveys a lot of information in a much more comprehensive and visual format so that you can leave space for just the narrative to those things that can only be told in words. Let me give you one quick example. I took a trip to the then Soviet Union back 4 or 5 years ago. And while I was gone, I knew that there was a big First Amendment case coming up. And I asked my assistant to make sure and get me clips on that case so I could see it when I came back. So when I arrived back on my desk from this particular thing was a clip from the New York Times, the Washington Post, and USA Today on this story. The Washington Post story was 60-some inches long. The New York Times story was 30 inches long. And the USA Today story was just over 15 inches, which is pretty good size for a USA Today story. I laid them side by side and compared the facts and the information in it. I got, in the Washington Post story, a lot of anonymous sources, a lot of blown-out, padded coverage that did not even have the key paragraph until 16 or 17 inches down into the story. The New York Times, shorter and a little more to the point, and it did use quotes that were intelligible and attributable to people. But the USA Today story had more information, and all of its quotes were attributed to real people, and it gave more information in the sense that it also told me everything that was in the other two stories, plus it told me about whether or not there was going to be appeal of this court case or not. The bottom line being that you don't necessarily have length to convey a lot of information. It just takes a lot of editing time and rewriting.
And so instead of being lightweight, it may be leading the way to a better kind of journalism from your perspective?
No, and I think that's a mistake that is made a lot of times about USA Today. USA Today was never designed to be a first read for a newspaper reader. It's a supplementary publication. And that's a mistake that a lot of people make, and a lot of newspaper people make. That's why you see so much copying of ideas and so much doing things the USA Today way, because people out there saw that it was a success, and in desperation to shore up their own bottom lines, said, well, if this is what the readers want, let's give it to them. Totally abandoning the idea, not totally abandoning, but in many cases getting them too far away from the idea of community journalism, which is the best kind of journalism. USA Today was never designed or intended to replace the community newspaper, and it shouldn't.
You used the word community at a dinner I attended last night in relationship to journalism. I think what you said is that as this country becomes more diverse, more eclectic in its definition of itself, it will be the journalism that will bind, it will be newspapers and the press that will tie us together as a community. Tell me what you mean by that. It's not just reporting the births and deaths and...
Well, it's not just that, but that's an important part of it. We go to the newspaper each day, if it's a good newspaper, for information about ourselves. It helps us carry on a conversation among ourselves without the physical presence of the other people and the other members of the community. It keeps us in touch when we can't physically see one another and know what's going on, in the sense that it tells us who's died, who's born, who's in the hospital, who's gotten married, who's gotten arrested, who's gone to jail, and who's been elected to the school board, and who's asking for a tax, and who's opposing it, and who's wanting to rezone the neighborhood, and all of those sorts of things. That is the heart and soul of a newspaper, because that is the heart and soul of the community. And it restores that sense of community, and it affirms that sense of community, and it helps that transcend all the smaller communities that we are devolving into. So, to me, that is the most vital role that a press can play, is restoring and protecting that larger sense of community that we have to survive as a democracy.
How well is the press doing that job, whether on television, radio, or in newspapers?
Not as well as we should, because we find ourselves too often chasing one of those smaller communities rather than keeping a sense of the larger community in mind as we make our decisions on what to cover and how to cover it. We in the newsroom are not inoculated against political correctness ourselves. We tend to chase after trends ourselves. We tend to be as blind sometimes as the average person to the bigger picture. And that's just a human failing. It's no conspiracy. It's no intent to do evil. And it is not necessarily a sign of not being good at our jobs. But we all, being human, do fall down on the job occasionally.
Is it the responsibility of the press to be adversarial as well as reflective?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that the press also needs to take a leadership role in this way, in making journalism better. I don't think it's up to the press to tell what people what to do. I think certainly the press can play a role on its editorial pages of saying this is wrong or this is right. But that's on the editorial page, and that people can take it or leave it. People understand that. It's when that editorializing creeps onto the end of a stand-up by a television correspondent or into the middle of a paragraph in a report written by a news correspondent for a newspaper, when the public out there says, hey, wait a minute, that's not right. That's not what you're supposed to be doing. I can make up my mind for myself. But we in the press, too many of us have become stars. Too many of us have become names, and too many of us have become so impressed with ourselves that we can't be content with just delivering the information. We've got to deliver ourselves of a sermon also, and that hurts our credibility, I think.
And I wonder if that's something that's as much a responsibility of the star makers as it is of the stars. I mean, we all go watch Dan Rather or Barbara Walters. We do make you stars and then get angry at you for being that thing.
And again, it's that public insistence on having entertainment to wash down the news with. And it's a dangerous addiction. And I call it an addiction advisedly. We have to be titillated. We have to be shocked in order to gain our attention anymore. We have to shout with our headlines. I was flying to Washington the other day thinking about the newscast that I'd seen the night before, and I was saying to myself, Wouldn't it be nice if Dan Rather or Connie Chung or Peter Jennings or Tom Brokaw had the guts on a given night to come on and say, "Good evening, America. We don't have any really big stories that are earth-shaking today, but we've got a lot of interesting material to give you, and we think that this will be something that you need to stay with." We're not able to do that, mainly because of the public's attention span. We have got to come on shouting. We have got to say the story of the day is the most important thing that's ever happened in the history of the world. And that tells the public that they have no context. There is no perspective. We in the media are not doing our job as gatekeepers. We're not doing our job of making sense of that vast array of information out there. We're not helping our viewers and our readers and our listeners. We're not arranging issues in context or in priorities. And so it's just a huge cacophony of different events, and our world becomes episodic rather than understandable.
Are we going to get over our need for fireworks and cotton candy?
I sure hope so. But I think it'll take some high-profile people daring to be different and daring to endure low ratings for a sustained period of time before they start ratcheting up again. The McNeil-Lehrer Report has made it for years and years and years by not shouting and screaming at the people. I think there's that sometimes we are our own worst enemies and that we underestimate the public out there. It might be that instead of fighting for a big piece of the small pie, that we ought to be fighting more for a small piece of the big pie. And I think that's a mistake that we make today. I think that in throughout the press, that if we just stopped for a moment and reconsidered our desperate chase after the readers and the ratings and got back to some more basic kinds of journalism, that the readers and ratings would start chasing us. And even if they didn't, at least we'd die with some respect.
What an ending line. Paul McMasters, thank you very much for an interesting hour.
Thank you.
This has been Conversations on KUAC-FM. Paul McMasters, as I said, has, just as we are listening, stepped down from a year-long tenure as the president of the Society for Professional Journalists. It's been a volunteer position, during which time he has spent much of his time talking about the First Amendment and the press in the United States. He is currently a vice president for the Freedom Forum, headquartered in Arlington, Virginia, and the executive director of the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. I hope you join me again next week. Thanks again.